Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be reading from a phenomenal book, one which I believe has really got a fraction of the recognition it deserves, Savage Continent by Keith Lowe. Often on this podcast I've extolled the virtues of historians like Tony Judd and Adam Tooze, who have the ability of to create these vast and highly detailed tableaus of interwar and post-war history. Well, Keith Lowe has done the same with Savage Continent, and he talks about a very under-discussed period, which would be the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. From the final months of the war in 1945 all the way through to kind of 47 to 48. And in many countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, conflict was ongoing. In many countries in both East and West Europe, after the end of hostilities against Germany and Italy, the Axis powers, civil conflicts continued, and the questions, the political questions, ideological questions thrown up by the war, of collaboration and the really civil wars that had been fought during the Second World War continued to produce cycles of retribution and displacement of people. And so what we're going to look at today is the experience that Western and East European countries had of citizens at the end of official hostilities not being able to trust one another, to see collaborators everywhere. And in many cases, this lack of trust was entirely justified because there had been, in many European countries, significant numbers of collaborators. So, Keith Lowe writes, at the height of the war, Germany directly or indirectly controlled more than a dozen countries across Europe and exercised enormous influence in half a dozen more. For all their military might, the Nazis could not have done this without the help of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of collaborators in those countries. No matter how much the people of Europe hated the Germans in the immediate aftermath of the war, they hated collaborators more. Germans at least had the excuse that they were part of a foreign culture, a foreign power. Collaborators, by contrast, were traitors to their own countries. And in the fiercely patriotic atmosphere that permeated Europe at the end of the war, this was an unforgivable sin. At the end of the war, of course, every country wanted to consider itself having resisted. Every country wanted to consider itself having not really been occupied, but have been fighting a spirited battle against the Germans. However, in many cases, this wasn't actually true, and that an immense amount of guilt for becoming implicated in the crimes of the enemy, particularly the crimes against the Jews, and also an immense amount of really hurt masculine pride of having been occupied, having been forced into a position of collaboration. The dehumanisation of collaborators, writes Keith Lowe, in the aftermath of the war is difficult for modern generations to understand. In the European press, they were portrayed as vermin, mad dogs, or inferior elements that needed to be cleansed from society. In Denmark and Norway, they were depicted in popular arts as rats, while in Belgium, the collective animosity towards them, according to British observers, was akin to a religious fervour. In such an atmosphere, it was hardly surprising that some people became violent towards them. As Peter Voet, a doctor who worked with the Dutch resistance, noted after the war, deep hatred of the collaborators and a desire for revenge was so widespread that some kind of punishment was inevitable. Though it was on everyone's mind, no one really knew what form this retaliation would take. There were rumours of a day of axes when the mob would take the law into its own hands. So there was a version of this retribution in almost every European country. The wartime leaders, many of whom were arrested and trialled, so people like Vidkun Quisling in Norway, Pierre Laval in France. But further down the tree, local mayors and administrators, people who had been kind of useful kind of local and regional apparatchiks for not just the Nazis, but collaborationist governments. Policemen who had been the enforcers of the rules, sometimes highly enthusiastic enforcers, always remember that it was not German soldiers that arrested Anne Frank, but Dutch policemen. The far-right militias who had been emboldened by fascist governments, and those who had written repressive laws. There had been prominent collaborationist industrialists who had done very well out of Nazi contracts, and also on a much, much lower level, restaurateurs, cafe owners, people who supplied foodstuffs to Nazi barracks and garrisons, people who had been involved in the media, who had written news stories in favour of the occupation forces, or who had been broadcasters or filmmakers for disseminating Nazi propaganda. Actors and singers were who had been happy to or coerced into entertaining German troops, and priests who had openly spoken out in favour of fascist policies. It seems clear that these figures, obviously a great many of them deeply morally compromised by the collaboration, also become lightning rods for the rest of society, who either suffered in frustration, who actively resisted, or for the most part who accepted their lot reluctantly and wished for an end to the war. There were a particular group who were singled out for hatred were women who had slept with Nazi soldiers, i.e. either single women who had soldiers, who had relationships with soldiers, or prostitutes who had been who had sex with soldiers. And of course, the dividing line between the two was deliberately blurred when the occupation came to an end, and women who were not prostitutes at all were often decried as being so, and publicly shamed in all sorts of demeaning ways. For some women, they were forced to prove their innocence. There were, in many European countries, women who had perhaps exchanged a pleasantry with a German soldier, or who had smiled as one had waved, were then forced to prove that they hadn't harboured some sort of unspoken feeling. And then when you get down to that level, you're looking at sort of gossip and insinuation and the kind of culture of denunciation that you ironically saw in the Stalinist Russia and in Nazi Germany. Kietzler writes, "Every form of vengeance shown to Germans in Czechoslovakia and Poland, the Czechs and the Poles expelled Germans extremely violently, and these were ethnic civilian Germans from their territories, was also visited upon collaborators and fascists across Europe. During the chaos of liberation, Dutch and Belgian collaborators were summarily executed and their houses burned down, while the police looked on with indifference and even approbation. In Italy, the bodies of fascists were displayed in the streets, where they could be kicked or spat at by passers-by. Even Mussolini's corpse was treated like this, before being suspended from the roof of a petrol station in Milan's Piazzale Loreto. In Hungary, members of the far-right Arrow Cross Party were forced to exhume Jewish mass graves in very hot weather, while local people threw sticks and stones at them. In France, clandestine prisons were set up where suspected collaborators were subjected to various forms of sadism, including mutilation, rape and enforced prostitution, and every other type of torture imaginable." So these were often the acts of civilians, of the kind of vigilantes, if you will, people who had appointed themselves fascist hunters and collaboration hunters. There was a culture in liberated Paris of hunting down fascists for those who had not been able to participate in the Maquis, in the resistance. It suddenly, when the opportunity arose, became very popular to try to reclaim some honour from the years of occupation. The Allied authorities who occupied Germany, Austria, and who established very short-lived military governments in places like the Netherlands before a civilian government could be elected, witnessed these events with no small amount of horror. Even the resistance themselves found, in European countries, found the stories distressing. If you imagine in Italian partisan groups and French resistance groups, their focus had been on fighting the Nazis, and this had to be done in a highly disciplined manner. The Maquis may have been many things, but a kind of a lynch mob they were not. "The terrible thing is," reported La Terre Vivreuse newspaper in October 1944, "that we are repeating some of the most heinous procedures carried out by the Gestapo. It would seem that Nazism has intoxicated a number of individuals to the point where they believe that violence is always legitimate and they can do whatever they please to choose to those they consider to be their adversaries, and that everyone has the right to take another person's life. What was the point of triumphing over the barbarians if only to imitate them and become like them?"
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This was highly damaging to the Allied occupation authorities, who had no desire to see anarchy and lynch mob justice reign. If you imagine that this was being written in October 1944, when the outcome of the war was still to be decided, there was still another 7 months until the defeat of the Third Reich, and it was very, very injurious to the Allied cause to show scenes of murder in public, and or to hear of kidnappings and interrogation cells and tortures. Another challenge was to the civilian governments that had been governments in exile, mainly living in Great Britain, and who returned to Western Europe. The first thing that they needed to do was establish their monopoly on state violence, if you will, to control the army and police force of countries like Belgium, the Netherlands, or France. And then secondly, to ensure that vigilante violence stopped. The thing that no government can tolerate on returning to power is a challenge to its monopoly on state power. And so the threat that vigilantism and the subversion of the rule of law presented to them was significant. Now, the desire to prevent the lynching of collaborators had nothing to do with sentimentality or a sense of fair play. There, I have no doubt that there were few sympathies towards anyone who had collaborated, but in order to establish a successful administration that was able to stabilise formerly occupied countries, you needed to stop mob justice happening. Charles de Gaulle said, "Public order is a matter of life and death, and absolutely all improvised authorities must stop." He wanted the French people to be in no mistake about who was now in charge. So, Keith Lowe writes, "The new governments of Western Europe attacked the problem from several angles at once. Firstly, recognising that part of the problem was the people's lack of faith in the police, they did whatever they could to bolster the position of the police force as the most important pillar of law and order. In some areas, particularly in Italy and Greece, they merely relied on massive Allied presence to provide support. But in others, they tackled the problem head-on by purging suspect officers from the force. Within a year of the liberation of France, for example, one policeman in every 8 had been suspended, and one of 5 French detectives had lost their jobs. In other countries followed suit. The purge of the police in Norway and Denmark was equally impressive, although perhaps less so in the rest of Western Europe. The important thing was to restore the legitimacy of the police so that they could stand up to the vigilantes who had taken control in many towns and neighbourhoods." The vigilantes relied on public support. Without public support, vigilantes tend to kind of fizzle out because they have no mob to appeal to. If one continues to have corrupt fascist police officers whom everybody knows what they've been doing during the war and who can't keep secrets from the people that they police, then there'll be every reason for the mob to support vigilantes who claim to have a greater moral legitimacy. And during the period of occupation, the question of moral currency is incredibly important. Who has been tainted and who has not is the basis of how countries like France and Belgium managed to survive into the long term. It is the key question of public life. So removing tainted police officers was absolutely vital. New authorities set about trying to disarm the groups of former resistors who had either been given supplies of weapons from the Allies or who had stolen weapons from the Germans. And, of course, as we can see in virtually every peaceful, stable country in the world, an armed population is a very, very bad idea. And the state must always restore its monopoly on violence. The process of removing weapons from resistance and partisans was quite difficult. In Paris, for example, the patriotic militia continued to conduct armed patrols in open defiance of the authorities. In Valenciennes, they maintained a huge secret arms cache, which include grenades, anti-aircraft machine guns and anti-tank rifles. In Brussels, where members of the secret army were given 2 weeks to disband a protest demonstration degenerated into a minor riot. The police opened fire, wounding 45 people. In Italy and Greece, thousands of partisans refused to give up their weapons for the simple reason that they did not trust the authorities, which still, even after the bloodshed of liberation, contained countless people who were tainted with connections to the old regime. Particularly in Italy, the ability of fascists to seamlessly drift into civilian life was particularly pronounced. If you go back a few months, perhaps earlier on this year, you'll find my 6-part series on Italian post-war fascism, which really, really helps to kind of illustrate that. So it's understandable that if you had been a communist partisan in northern Italy fighting the fascists under the Salo Republic, and you were asked at the end of the war by American soldiers or British soldiers or the new Italian government to hand in your guns, you might think no, because those guys that we shot up 6 months ago, they know who we are, we know who they are, and they're going to come and settle some scores at some point in the not too distant future. The fascists, as far as you're concerned, have not gone away. They've had a blow, they've lost the war, but they're still around. The attempts to coax former partisans back into civilian life revolved around offering amnesties, because not all the partisans at work in countries like France and Italy were whiter than white. Some had committed crimes, some had executed those that they suspected to be collaborators, or robbed banks, or done various other things in order to survive. In Belgium, the authorities were willing to turn a blind eye to almost any resistance activities that occurred in the 41 days after the Germans had been ejected. In Italy, amnesty on revenge killings covered the first 12 weeks after the end of the war. And in Czechoslovakia, it lasted an astonishing 5.5 months. Now, in that, there is a kind of like a nod and a wink from the government, that if you want to sort things out, you've got 12 weeks to do it in. So if you want to settle some scores with some people who will probably be a proper nuisance to the incoming government, then do it. Czechoslovakia is slightly different, because Czechoslovakia and much of Eastern Europe, as agreed at Yalta between Roosevelt, Stalin and Churchill, was to be ethnically cleansed of Germans. So that 5.5 months was really about terrorising ethnic Germans out of the country. But if crimes of passion committed in the heat of liberation were regarded with leniency, those committed much later, when power was supposed to have been returned to the state, were punished extremely harshly. In France, for example, a series of arrests of former Maquisards in the winter of 1944-45 was widely interpreted as a warning to the resistance to bring an end to the lynch mob justice. These measures were fairly ineffectual. The real problem, and the main reason why the lynch mobs were so common, was that many people believed vengeance to be their only recourse to justice. The British ambassador to Paris, Alfred Duff Cooper, wrote, "So long as people believe that the guilty will be punished, they are prepared to leave them to the law. But when they begin to doubt this is so, they will take the law into their own hands." In the aftermath of the war, these doubts were everywhere. The only way to stop revenge attacks was to convince the people that the state was capable of administering what the Belgian newspapers called justice sévère et expéditif, so real, proper, harsh justice. The difficulty for the Allied powers, as they found in Germany, and for former occupied, the new governments of former occupied states, was that denazification and de-vichification and de-collaborationification is incredibly difficult. When you're looking at hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands perhaps in each country, hundreds of thousands European-wide, possibly even into the millions if you consider all the numbers of people implicated in Nazism in Germany, then removing them from public life, arresting them, punishing them, imprisoning them, becomes almost impossible in a continent with food shortages, a refugee crisis, a shattered infrastructure. It becomes unthinkable to take away huge chunks of the skilled workforce who had collaborated, and allowing things to be swept under the carpet becomes a matter of political expediency. It's for these reasons that you have later on in Germany in the 1960s all sorts of questions about who did what during the war, which are kind of contributory to the student unrest of the late 1960s. Anyway, I'm going to finish there. Thanks very much for listening. And you can find us at the Explaining History Facebook group. There's always some cool articles and debates that I post there. And you can also find us on Patreon as well. Obviously, all contributions gratefully accepted. And I'll look forward to catching you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.